So, what is wisdom? Where does it come from? How do we achieve it? We want wise leaders. We want to make wise decisions. How do we do this? I won't keep you in suspense. I don't have an answer. But we can explore these questions. There are certainly an unending array of sources for wisdom: the Bible, other holy and spiritual books, gods, ancient rulers, philosophers, the lovers of wisdom, advice columns, our parents, general books often focused on self-help and empowerment, Hallmark cards, business leaders, politicians, advertising slogans, and even graffiti. From 1738 to 1758, Benjamin Franklin published Poor Richard's Almanac, which in addition to weather, a calendar, poems, astronomical and astrological information, also provided sayings, aphorisms, and proverbs. Let's call them for the moment little nuggets of wisdom. Things like, three may keep a secret if two of them are dead. Well done is better than well said. And the worst wheel of the cart makes the most noise. If all I wanted to do was provide you with some nuggets of wisdom, I might tell you, lean in, just do it, build bridges. You deserve a break today. Good fences make good neighbors. Never give up, never surrender. Forgive and forget. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. Think outside the box. Try something new. Take the road less traveled. Perhaps there is wisdom in these, but they seem more like an end product that may or may not apply to me or to you or to each of our situations. They become platitudes, cliches, or in the world of internet memes, popular nothings. Mae West once said, "Between two evils, I always pick the one I never tried before." Terry Pratchett said, "I'll be more enthusiastic about encouraging thinking outside the box when there's evidence of any thinking going on inside it." So both used humor in their statements to deconstruct a nugget of wisdom. In the case of Mae West, she builds her humor on the commonly heard argument of always selecting the lesser of two evils. And Terry Pratchett uses his statement to question the implicit assumption that thinking is actually taking place anywhere, inside or outside of the box. So ask yourself, how do I apply the wisdom of good fences make good neighbors? Do I build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, the U.S. and Canada, between each state, between each county, between each city, between each house, between each person? Or how about the worst wheel of the cart makes the most noise? That seems true. I had a bad shopping cart at the grocery store. But what if I put on my industrialist cap and apply this to my workers? Forming a union? Bad wheel making a lot of noise there. Better replace it. A whistleblower complaining about my sordid working conditions? Another bad wheel needs to be replaced. I'm sure most of you have heard the phrase, "If you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, but if you teach him to fish, you feed him for a lifetime." By applying this phrase to our little nuggets of wisdom, we discover that they are nothing more than giving a man a fish. And there's nothing wrong with that, assuming the man, who could also be a woman or trans or outside the heteronormative world that we so commonly believe is all there is not vegan or vegetarian or allergic to fish, and the fish is not the last of its kind or overfished or poisonous or particularly nasty tasting or recently stolen from a fishmonger, and that the person really could use a fish. But the fish in this case is not wisdom. Let me make the phrase mathematical. If you give a person the number 42, you provide the answer to any math problem that has the answer of 42. But if you teach the person math, the person will find there are a lot more answers and problems out there, and that any particular number they have received may not be the answer to their problem. So wisdom is not a set of answers. It's not nuggets you can pick and choose among and give away. It is something more like math and fishing. Somewhere around 1934, the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr created what became known as the Serenity Prayer. The most common form of the prayer is this: God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. This prayer got used in various sermons at the Heath Evangelical Union Church in Heath, Massachusetts, and was eventually published in 1951 in a magazine column. It went on from there to be adopted and popularized by Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs. I think it's a great prayer, and I'm not much of a fan for praying, as for the most part, I don't really know what prayer is. But I like this prayer because it is not simply saying, God, take care of everything for me. Instead, it is saying, God, help me to make good decisions. It's still me having to make the decisions. It's me taking ownership of those decisions. But I could really use some outside help. In this prayer, Reinhold Niebuhr implicitly proposes a definition of wisdom, one that I like. Wisdom, he suggests, is the ability to know the difference between choices, especially choices between things that can actually be done and matter, and those that are truly beyond my capabilities and control. Here again is my thesis. Wisdom is a way of applying knowledge and experience to decisions. It is not an answer or set of answers, but rather a process of critical thinking tied to acting in the world to do something. Let's briefly take a look at our two readings and then talk about the elephant in the room. When I first heard the story of the decision of Solomon that Sue read, I was pretty young. Like various inherited nuggets of wisdom, the story was handed to me, in this case, as part of a religious upbringing. The story very patly tells us what it wants us to think, especially the ending. They perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to execute justice. Whew. Don't have to think about that one anymore. King Solomon is wise. Wisdom comes from God. Got it. But I really disliked this story. It nagged at me. King Solomon did resolve an issue, two women claiming the same baby. Which one is the real mom? The resolution? Chop the baby in half. What? Fake mom doesn't care. Real mom does. And ta-da, real mom gets the baby back. Chopping was just a ruse to get the truth. Really? No, I don't think so. For the threat of chopping a child in half to be credible, it has to be believed. And what would indicate to me that chopping was not just a ruse? And that would indicate to me that chopping was not just a ruse. Chopping had to be believed. So, is the wisdom here that violence discerns truth? That implied violence is okay if it is successful in its goal? If so, then hello, Abu Ghraib. The problem for me is that this story from the Bible seems like a misapplication of what I call the last banana solution. The last banana solution goes like this. My wife and I sit down to breakfast. We each get a bowl of cereal. We recognize via the instructions on the box that the bowl of cereal is only part of a complete breakfast. We each reach for the last banana. Uh-oh. We can't both have it, but our brilliant daughter arrives to save the day. Half a banana is, in fact, an acceptable serving of fruit, she tells us. A whole banana would, in fact, be two servings of fruit. She chops the banana in half, lengthwise, as this is somehow more wise than crosswise, and gives half to each of us. Breakfast is a success. And no babies were threatened in this story. Just to be sure, I'm including this caution. Do not substitute baby for banana in this story. Despite my issues, assuming that the Solomon story contained what many people found to be wisdom, I would state the following. It is out of date in the use of suggested violence to discern a truth. Although some people in governments may still apply this kind of coercion, it is not considered wisdom by everyone. And as a society, we have specifically agreed to laws indicating that it's a bad idea. There are other nonviolent technological methods that could now be applied to resolve the situation. For example, genetic testing. And this story is really too simplistic. Suppose we gave it the following twist. What if the child in the story were a prince instead of a prostitute's son? Would you take a sword to him? What if in the original story, neither woman agrees to have the child chopped in half? No, King Solomon, that's stupid. Don't chop a kid in half. What if in the original story, the actual mother agrees to have the child chopped in half? Because she's thinking reverse psychology or something. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead, chop him in half. How does he make his decision? What if the original story, both women agree to let the child be chopped in half? Does this end badly? What if the story takes into account modern technology? Say a woman is hired as a surrogate and she gestates the child, but she does not supply the ovum. At birth, she wants to keep the child. Can she? Or a woman is hired as a surrogate, she supplies the ovum and gestates the child. At birth, she wants to keep the child. Can she? In any of these altered scenarios, do we know how the story will end? What will Solomon do? In each case, we have to rethink what needs to be done. To sum up, as we have seen with other nuggets of wisdom, the actual solution applied in this case is not the wisdom. Whatever discernment Solomon had that made the solution he applied work, but which the story fails to describe in any detail, there's no Watson here to get Sherlock Holmes to explain his insight, is not in the story. The story suggests there is wisdom. It does not make us wise. But it leads me to update my thesis and argue that wisdom has ties to specific cultures, to specific places, times, and events. Its solutions cannot be handed down or inherited. It does not form principles that are applicable to all situations. As a form of critical thinking, wisdom constantly must add new methods of ascertaining answers and truths and new ways of applying solutions to reach a desired outcome. In the piece by David Foster Wallace called Just Asking, Wallace leads us via a series of questions to recognize there is an ongoing conflict between freedom, as expressed in the American idea, and security. Although Wallace's piece focuses primarily on issues raised by terrorism and the human reaction to secure ourselves against it, it is designed not as answers, but as nothing but questions. Wallace asks, why now can we not have a serious national conversation about sacrifice, the inevitability of sacrifice, either of some safety or some portion of the rights and liberties that make the idea, American idea, so precious? For Wallace, the implication is that wisdom is very much about both asking the questions and continuing to think through to answers. In his design of asking question after question, he implies that there is no single pat answer, but a continuous act of balancing and rebalancing between opposing conditions. In this case, between freedom and security. Our action is to keep asking the questions and to find answers that are communally acceptable to our society, and not simply to have the imposition of reactive answers, like the Patriot Acts, to be the final determination. In other words, he is telling us to apply Reinhold Niebuhr's courage to change the things I can a whole lot more. His critique is that we have become too complacent, too serene about things. Wisdom always has to ask, is this something that I just need to accept or something I should change? There is, in the end, no settled answer. The question can always be re-asked and re-answered. This gives wisdom the ability to take into account societal and historical change, to roll with the times, to be itself changing. And now we come to the elephant in the room. How do we apply wisdom to something like gun violence and gun control? You can go online, or even better yet, to your local library and find a huge variety of arguments about guns and gun control. Typical questions include, are shootings a serious problem? Will stricter gun control reduce shootings? Do violent video games cause shootings? Would improvements in mental health care reduce shootings? Does the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, prevent us from making gun control laws? Do guns increase the risk of suicide? Do the presence of guns escalate violence? Do guns create a false sense of security? How much does gun violence in the U.S. cost in taxes, medical expenses, prosecution, and imprisonment? Can gun control stop criminals? Do guns prevent crimes? Are guns a good form of self-defense? Is gun control too difficult to enforce? Would it just create black markets and organized crime? Will gun control laws discourage people from acting responsibly? I'm not going to answer any of these questions. There are books you can and should read which lay out the various arguments and offer statistics and approaches to all of these questions. The answers, in the end, are not themselves wisdom. They're just answers people have given which may or may not help. Instead, I'm going to go back to the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Do I need to just accept gun violence? Is there something here I can change? Can doing something improve the world in some way? Question: are some things worth dying for? Is owning a gun one such thing? Are we willing to regard the yearly deaths of some 37,000 people by guns as part of the price of the American right to bear arms? Are we willing to accept the fact that 2 to 3 times every year, despite everyone's best efforts, some 50 to 100 of us may die in a terrible suicidal attack, that because of the importance of the right to bear arms, we cannot protect against without subverting the very principle of the right to bear arms? Or do we need to talk and keep talking to find a way to change?